Hi, everybody. I'm delighted to have Sophie Krainin with us today on Economics Matters, the podcast. So of late, I've been doing some podcasts on economics of different occupations, industries, and we just did one on economics of film, and then we just did another one on economics of mining, and today we're going to do one on the economics of restaurants with Sophie Krainin, who's I guess a restaurateur would be the right term. Would that be a fair statement? But she's
absolutely
multifaceted. Let me just give you a quick read of her bio. So she grew up, I think, in Massachusetts, right? Her first exposure was at a clam shack to the restaurant industry. She's working at a clam shack on Cape Cod in high school. And then she got working at an ice cream parlor. And then she decided this was kind of her calling, hospitality. And then she went to Tulane, where that's in New Orleans, where obviously some of the best food in the world is located. And she worked in the French Quarter, learning about po'boys, I guess it was the way it's expressed, and crawfish by the pound. And then she came back, worked at a retail store, managed that in Nantucket. And then she was working also in two nearby restaurants at the same time. And from there, she started an HR software company. So she kind of went into the HR business, but connected to the restaurant business. And then she joined Barbara Lynch, who's a very famous chef in Boston and owner of a variety of excellent restaurants. So she's a big name, Barbara Lynch. So working with Barbara Lynch is... A, it's not easy to land the job, and B, it's probably not easy to keep the job because Barbara, as I understand, it's pretty demanding. So, but she became Barbara's executive assistant, coordinating travel, events and appearances, and learning more about marketing the brand, Barbara's brand and concepts. And Barbara has so many different kinds of restaurants that you get a real education, I'm sure, hanging out. I've never met her, but so it's all apocryphal. I'm imagining what this experience must have been like. And then she started working with Eastern Standard Provisions, which is a kind of part of the Eastern Standard. And maybe you can tell us about Eastern Standard, and because you're now working with Eastern Standard full time in one of their new restaurants. And I have to say, her CV says that she. When she's not being a workaholic, she hangs out with her dog, runs long distances, skis downhill and cross country, and she reads. And we'll have to ask her what you read, what you're reading of late. If you have any recommendations? But anyway, welcome to this podcast, and give us a little bit of your trajectory from birth to today. Where exactly were you born? How many pounds did you weigh when you were born? That's my first question. But no, just take us up to the current. Tell us about Eastern Standard and its founder but give us the journey.
Sure. I grew up outside of Massachusetts. I'll skip over the first 18 years because they're not super salient. But I knew I wanted to experience something totally different from Metro Boston. So I applied to schools pretty much exclusively out of the New England area. I figured what better opportunity to see something different than college. So I went to Tulane University in New Orleans. I studied public health and linguistics, which was, you know, I came to realize more of an academic passion of mine. I loved studying public health. I loved linguistics. But when it came time for me to start thinking about what I wanted to do professionally, I found myself for some reason just struggling to click send on applications for any public health jobs, you know, or anything kind of in the field. So while I was mulling over whether I should get a master's in public health or what my next step would be, the summer after I graduated from college, I came back to the Boston area and I had been managing a women's clothing store on Cape Cod. And they sent me out to Nantucket for the summer. And I said, this is great. I'll have a great summer of going to the beach and drinking Mai Tais and, you know, selling dresses. And it turns out to be a little bit more stressful than that. The store that I managed has since changed ownership, but would do about $3 million in sales in gross revenue over the course of really 2.5 months of business. Nantucket is so seasonal and, you know, and the pace is pretty intense. It's fun being out there, you know, but it shaves a couple of years off your life every summer you're out there. You make your money for sure, but it's intense. But I loved the pace. I loved the people that I was meeting out there. And while I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life, I started looking at some jobs around the country. And there was one job I was particularly interested in. And they said, your resume looks great. You have, you know, some events experience from a large scale crawfish festival I had managed on campus at Tulane. But they said, you have no real restaurant experience. I said, what about my clam shack days? And they said, that doesn't really count. So I had some time and the store, you know, had quieted down by then, considering it was past the high summer season. So I started managing the store during the day. I would close the store at 6 and I would run over to a couple of restaurants up the street and I would work there until 11 p.m. or midnight. And I would do the same thing pretty much every day after that. And I loved it. I immediately felt like I found a community of guests and staff that understood me. And, you know, and I loved to talk to people. I loved to talk about food and I loved to talk to people about food. So it just felt like a total, it just felt like kismet. I left the island later that fall, early winter, moved back to Boston, had some interviews with some groups, including actually with Garrett's restaurant group in 2014.
But this is Garrett. Now, give us Garrett's whole background, who Garrett is. Not everybody knows who Garrett is.
Sure. Garrett is Garrett Harker, who is a legendary restaurateur in Boston, owner of Eastern Standard, which was an establishment in Boston for 15 years, opened in 2005 in Kenmore Square. Garrett also owns, adjacent to Eastern Standard, a restaurant called Island Creek Oyster Bar, a cocktail bar called The Hawthorne, a seafood and beer joint called Row 34. Another seafood restaurant called Les Sablons and a restaurant in Watertown, Massachusetts called Branch Line. So Garrett really had his hands in so many different projects and operations, you know, happening at so many different levels.
I should also say that my wife was working as a property manager for the Branch Line, was one of the properties that she was managing. So my wife, Bridget Jorgensen, knew Garrett far much, you know, before I wandered into your new location and met you and met Garrett again. I met him once. So it was a very small world. We also had our reception for our wedding at the restaurant 34 in South Boston.
Yeah. That's wild. My husband and I also had our reception for our wedding at Branch Line in Watertown.
There you go. So it really is a small world. Yeah,
it really is. Garrett had actually worked with Barbara. Garrett grew up in Baltimore, became one of the youngest general managers in Kimpton, in the Kimpton Hotel Group's history in California, and worked his way up as a manager, just, you know, started learning everything about the business. Prior to that, in Boston, he had worked for Roger Berkowitz at Legal Seafood, and came back to Boston to be Barbara Lynch's opening general manager of Number 9 Park. So opens Number 9 Park with her in 1998, and then the two of them opened the Butcher Shop and B&G Oysters in the South End of Boston in 2003.
Oh, okay.
And
so they're behind that, the restaurant at that place. Okay.
Exactly. And in, you know, they decided to part ways. Garrett needed something to do with his time. Kenmore Square was a little scary at the time that he started talking to Boston University, who owns Hotel Commonwealth and many of the buildings in Kenmore Square. It wasn't really a place you wanted to hang out. You didn't want to spend a lot of time at, you know, in Kenmore Square. You certainly didn't want to enjoy a nice cocktail and a plate of steak tartare. But Garrett started talking to some folks about opening a restaurant in that space. He needed something to do with his time. And he said, why not take a chance on me and let's see if we can make something magical. So Eastern Standard opens in 2005 and closed at its old location in 2020. And Garrett, you know, felt like that wasn't the end of the chapter. He really wanted to find somewhere that he could revitalize and bring back the Eastern Standard concept to continue telling that story. So we started construction in 2020, late 22, early 23, and opened at a new location, but with the same concept and a very similar menu in October.
So we need to advertise the where it is exactly. It's right. If you're going to go to the Red Sox, this is the place to go. Or if you're at all in the Kenmore Square, Boston area. I had lunch there with a colleague from physics department, and terrific. And you'll get to meet Sophie in person. So it's located, it's on Beacon Street, and it's set back a little bit, and it's right up from the intersection of Comm Ave and Beacon.
Correct.
Probably the best way to do it, but there's a specific address we should get.
775 Beacon Street. We're located in a new apartment complex called Bower, B-O-W-E-R.
Yeah. So it's,
and you know, you mentioned that it is a little challenging to find. It's, you know, it's interesting to think about where Kenmore Square was when the old Eastern Standard opened in 2005, and you know, where this new neighborhood, which feels a little bit more like Audubon Circle, they're calling it Fenway Center. You know, when we think about where this new neighborhood is, there's so much construction, so much development going on around us, a lot of life science. And it feels like we're really on the precipice of seeing this corner of Fenway explode. So it's a long game for sure. You know, we don't, yeah, have the foot traffic right now just because of how much construction is going on in the area. But, you know, I believe in Garrett as a placemaker. It's, you know, it's interesting when I look at my career trajectory, Barbara and Garrett and many other chefs that I've and owners that I've worked for they've taken a leap of faith on a neighborhood or on an area where you think that they're a little crazy for putting a restaurant there. But in time, you see the neighborhood build up around them, and you see the vision that, you know, that they were able to see. I am not a creative. I love what I do because I'm able to support creatives. I'm able to bring my passion for operations and efficiency and numbers to the table and support people who are visionaries, who say, you know, I'm envisioning this space looking this way. And that's not me. I can't look at a construction site and say, the bar is going to be over here, and we're going to have this little seating area with high top tables over here. And, you know, I say, great, I'll file the permits, you know, I'll get the investors on board. But you write the map of how everything looks, and you tell the story.
I'd like to talk to you about a really powerful financial planning tool to help you make smart retirement and other critical financial decisions. It's a tool that factors in all your financial data and shows you what you can sustainably spend every year for the rest of your life. That tool is my software company's Maxify Planner. It's incredibly powerful, it's accurate, and it's easy to use. Maxify takes the guesswork out of financial decisions at every stage of life. Its focus is on raising, de-risking, and sustaining your living standard. Maxify lets you run what-if scenarios to see how your finances will change in taking new jobs, buying a home, doing Roth conversions, retiring early, downsizing, investing more in the market, you name it. Knowing the impact of these decisions before you make them is the secret to making smarter decisions. And it's also the secret to what we all seek, which is financial peace of mind. So please visit Maxify.com today to start planning. That's Maxify with an I, M-A-X-I-F-I.com, Maxify.com. Now let's get back to the podcast. So let me ask you a couple questions here. So you started out, started managing on the Cape, the couple of restaurants, and then you started getting some other jobs in the intersection of HR and hospitality. How do you end up working with Barbara Lynch? I mean, this is a job probably everybody would have died to get, let alone coming from a linguistic background, right?
It was Barbara's such a study in linguistics. You know, it's how many times you can pepper the F word and whether it can be used as a
Southie accent verb. With a Southie accent, right?
Exactly, with the Southie accent. It's kind of an accent all its own. It's a total anthropological study on a different way of life. You know, I hated working at a desk job. I needed to be up and moving around. I tried that for 10 months just to say that I did it and you know, that I checked that box. But I was itching to get back into restaurants. I was actually simultaneously working a 9-to-5 job in software and hosting and food running at a restaurant at night. And that wasn't sustainable for me. And I said, you know what? I love this industry so much. I'd like to take the plunge full time into this business. And what I know is human resources. I've been learning a bit about hiring, performance management, you know, and a little bit about how that operates in restaurants. And I saw serendipitously that Barbara's group had posted for someone to process payroll, and administer benefits and handle kind of cultural human resources aspects of the restaurants. So I got that job. I did that for a year and a half, and Barbara was coming out with a memoir around the same time, and needed someone to assist with the business of Barbara, as we called it colloquially, which was outside of the restaurants. You know, she went on a pretty extensive book tour, and she had passion projects and ideas that we were working on trying to expand her presence outside of just the 7 restaurants based in Boston.
So she saw that you could do more than, let's say, bookkeeping. You guys became, you take this chance. I think it's very important for people. I like, you know, young people that are watching this are thinking about, how do I become Sophie if I think Sophie's got a cool job? How do I make my way? And it's kind of you kind of one step that doesn't look like it's going to go in the final direction that you want to be. Even taking that can lead to connections and opportunities, interactions that then, so at some point you start clicking with her and she says, well, can you help me with this? Right. Can you help me with this? And can you help me with this? Because she starts to see that you can do more than you might even yourself have known that you could do. Because as you're older and you've been managing people and working with people in different projects, you know that people can do things that they don't think they can do, but you know that they can do it. Is that a fair summing up?
Absolutely. You know, I firmly believe that my career is such a good example of, you know, every opportunity that I've taken and every connection that I've made has led me to another branch in my career. And it hasn't necessarily been entirely linear, but I've been able to take from these varied experiences in retail, in software, in, you know, in consumer packaged goods, certainly in restaurants and hospitality more broadly, and blend all of these tools that I've accumulated together to bring them to what I do now.
So I think that's really, you know, like a good guide to making a career, which is like take opportunities and you don't have to think about them being the end of the road. It's like the beginning of the road. You try things and then you move from there because you're going to meet someone maybe by accident, and things are going to, this small world nature of things really does happen. You know, the fact that my wife is really knows Garrett really well, to the point where when I mentioned her name to him, his face just beamed because they had a good relationship. And very interesting. But tell me, let's talk about for the next, like, say 15-20 minutes about the restaurant business. How we see is a lot of challenges right now because you have all the people working at home. You've got 20%, I think, across the country, office building vacancy, or maybe that's, I think it's around 20%. It might be higher in San Francisco, where I think is the worst example. So you don't have people coming into town and having lunch. So you have restaurants that were, formerly doing great, have closed. And, is it something that that you think is a good thing for? Would you recommend somebody start a restaurant without them having some special creativity, some special capacity for bringing new food or designing new food, some grandma's recipes that are just fantastic that they know they can, because it takes more than just being able to cook or know what's good food, but you have to have, tell us all about the challenges of, would you recommend becoming a restaurateur to somebody who's a young person?
It's the $1 million question. There's a joke in restaurants. What's the fastest way to make $1 million in the restaurant industry? Start with five. It's a profession of passion. You go into it because you love it, first and foremost. And if you don't have that, then you'll never be successful. You may make money, but you'll never enjoy what you do. And your guests will see it. Your staff will feel it. You have to love the nature of the work and the purpose of the work. And I firmly believe that every restaurant should have a purpose. Maybe your purpose is, I have an incredible chef, or, I learned how to cook from my grandmother, and my purpose is bringing my culinary talents to the masses. Maybe my purpose is, my food's okay. It's not amazing, but I want to provide a third place for people. We talk a lot in restaurants about third place. You have your home, you have work or school, and then we've lost this third place that so many folks used to have, and especially after COVID, don't have as much. For many people, that's that's a church or a temple. For many people, that's a hobby or a club that they meet with. But for many people, it's a restaurant. It's somewhere that they feel that they're at home, that they know the staff knows them, and that they're well taken care of. For some people, opening a restaurant, their purpose is placemaking and is providing a space for people to gather. And for some people, it's about cocktails. And I feel like I have something to say and something to contribute to the world of wine or cocktails or vermouth or sake or something like that. But the biggest threat to your restaurant, it's such an existential one, is when you don't really know what your mission statement is. You need to have a really clear identity when you open of, this is the purpose of our restaurant. It's to be, and sometimes it can be more than one thing. Eastern Standard, when I think about it, we strive to have, simple, delicious food in abundance for reasonable value, great cocktails, and really to provide that warm hospitality and that place that you feel like you can go and always have a seat and always be well taken care of. But if you don't have at least one of those things identified when you open, then there's no point. But the economics of restaurants are challenging, and especially post-COVID, where there was so much fluctuation of, you know, supply chain, and cost of goods got much more expensive, much harder to get, you know, packaging items, the cost of produce and protein went up, and the cost of labor went up. So that's why I say you always have to start from a place of loving what you do, because if you're in this to make $1 million, then there's a much faster and less painful way to make that money. This is really, it's a project for someone who is passionate about food or cocktails or people, and really, it has to be people above all.
And how much money do you need to really, you know, suppose you're like 30 and you don't have any, maybe you got 50,000 bucks in the bank. How do you actually start your restaurant? Is that like impossible? Or do you have to have some friends or relatives who are going to stake you? I mean, how much money for even a small establishment in a, maybe in a, not on, in the location you folks are at, but someplace, lower rent district, but maybe it's going to have fantastic something. You know, what's kind of a, do you have a sense of what the minimum amount of money you need to get off the ground would be?
It depends on the scope and the size of your project. So, you know, if you are interested in opening a small takeout coffee shop, in Melrose, Massachusetts, the financing required for that would be very different from a 300-seat restaurant in the theater district downtown Boston. You know, it depends on the structure of the deal that you're able to make with your landlord. You know, that they are the first person that you want to get on board. You want them to be excited about the opportunity and the energy that you're bringing to the neighborhood. So if you can get them on board and they'll give you some TI, tenant improvement, you know, either you're moving into a space that is brand new construction or has had an existing tenant before. So hopefully you're able to move somewhere where, you know, they've already run for electrical. It's already plumbed. The gas lines are already set up and you're bringing in kitchen equipment, for example. But in our case, it was brand new construction. So we're building everything from the ground up. So it depends on that, you know, but the first step is getting your landlord excited about your projects and willing to invest in you. The next step would be friends, angel investors, you know, potential new customers. There are a couple different ways that I've seen that people do this. There's a really interesting new model. I'm forgetting the name of the website, but you can now, for, you know, and this works typically for much smaller retail stores or small concepts, where you can allow guests, you know, and community members to buy gift cards to support your new projects, kind of like a Kickstarter. So people are able to contribute to your project any amount of money that they want. So that could be $200, $500, $1,000. And then they get rewarded the longer they sit on that credit. So they're receiving store credit in the value that they contributed to you once the project is fully funded and open.
So they get to get free meals in the future, maybe.
Exactly. For supporting your project financially, depending on the size of the project, you know, that may be enough. Typically it wouldn't be enough. You know, I've seen projects anywhere from, you know, $750,000 up to $20 million, depending on the size and the scope of the build out, because you need some startup capital to pay your,
you said 750,000 to what was the other number?
$20 million. Kind of, okay. At the upper end, depending on the size and scope of the project. I mean, you know, certainly there are
just to open the door.
You know, and then you want to make sure that you have some working capital so that, you're not opening the door on day one with, you know, with nothing in the bank to pay your payroll, to pay your vendors. It's a tricky balance. You need to load up on inventory in wine and liquor. It's all about kind of making sure that you're opening in the right season too. It's really tricky for restaurants to open, in late fall, early winter, because you want to open and start making money as quickly as you can.
Want more money, less risk, and a better life? Buy Money Magic, a new book by Lawrence Kotlikoff, Boston University economist, personal finance expert, and best-selling author. Whether it's education, career, marriage, housing, investing, retirement, Social Security, IRA, or 401k decisions, Money Magic delivers scores of secrets to raise your living standard. Financial journalist Jane Bryant Quinn says Money Magic is a must-read. Nobel laureate George Akerlof says Money Magic is quite probably the best financial advice book ever written. Financial guru John Malden says, you'll love this amazing book. It's full of wit, wisdom, and startling paths to a better financial life. And columnist Scott Burns calls Money Magic a funny, brilliant read, offering wildly powerful, unconventional choices that can literally change your life. Get Lawrence Kotlikoff's Money Magic today at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and independent booksellers.
Right. And then there's also how many people are going to actually show up tonight, and how much should I order in advance that could go bad, right? The food.
Right. The biggest drivers of cost in your restaurant are rent, labor, and cost of goods. So the cost of your of the product that you're buying, whether that's food or wine or liquor or beer, non-alcoholic beverage. Rent is, you know, can be anywhere from in a healthy restaurant, you want to see it less than 30% of your gross revenue. Labor, you want to see ideally 20-25%. And cost of goods, ideally, again, you want to see, you know, a blended cost of goods. Food is always going to, your margins are always going to be worse on food than they will be on liquor, which is why a healthy restaurant sells a lot of cocktails. You know, there's much more labor and prep associated with food, and you can't charge a 100% markup on a, you know, on a roasted chicken dish or a bowl of pasta. So, you know, you use that blends to inform your prices and, you know, to assist in making sure that your costs as a whole are healthy across the board. But, you know, when you start doing the math, rent, labor, cost of goods, that eats up a lot of your profits right there, not to mention direct operating costs, which are things like linens, flowers, china, glass, silverware,
cleaning,
janitorial supplies,
pot washing.
Yep, exactly. Dishwashing chemicals.
I was a pot washer in camp. I actually ran the kitchen. I ended up, I was in charge of the waitresses and waiters and the pot washers. And the pot washers weren't that great, so I would actually be there with the, you know, and I was actually, you know, a little bit smaller then, not that super tall now. But most of my body was inside the pot. This was, I recall,
It's that is hard work. I during COVID we were a ragtag crew of just the administrative team, and I worked some 18-hour days washing pots, and it is tough. The dishwashers in restaurants do not get enough credit. It's one of the most thankless jobs.
So is the Hobart still the main dishwasher machine?
Hobart has a monopoly on the dish machine industry. Which is you need those. They are the backbone of your restaurant. If that goes down, there's no hope for you. It's a really tough balancing act to make sure that that you're charging prices that will still have guests come in the door, but that you're making sure to cover your costs. Some of it comes from, like I said, working with your landlord to make sure that you have a rent deal that is feasible for you. A lot of landlords will charge a base rent and then percentage rent, which is a percentage of sales.
Become co-investors. I see. Right.
Exactly. You know, so that they are in essence commissioned off of your sales. So, you know, that is helpful for you. So in down months, you're not paying them as much in rent as you are in prosperous months.
Yeah. So it's, you know, as an economist, this strikes me as one of the most risky ventures, because you have, you know, if somebody doesn't like, there's so many restaurants, so, and it's like a discrete choice. So if I don't like it the first time, maybe I just had one of 30 dishes, I might give it one more try. But if I have two bad experiences or not fabulous experiences, I might say, well, why don't I try this other place? Because there's so many options. And then there's the issue of whether you're going to get, you know, whether you're marketing to repeat customers or tourists, because repeat, you know, tourists, in some sense, you don't care that much if they're not thrilled, because they're not going to be coming back anyway.
Right.
So you have that aspect, but then there's the whole advertising and getting, so how do you make adjustments along the way to, you know, if things aren't working out, do you fire the chef? Do you change the menu up? Do you do a survey of your customers? How do you get the feedback to kind of, the thing that I really think about is when I go into a new restaurant, so it gets a lot of attention in the media, everybody's big buzz, everybody talks about it. You go there, they've just set up, and so they don't have enough staff for this big rush of people. So there's a long wait to begin with, and that's not a great experience. And then, so almost like too much publicity at the beginning might be actually a curse. And then you sit down and they've had to, maybe the food's just not that good, except the concept is cool, but the food is not that fabulous at the price that they're setting. And you say, well, gee, what? Okay, we tried it once. Are we really going to go back again? And it wasn't, I'm talking about it, thinking about a restaurant in Providence that where I live that I'm not sure we would go back a third time. And then I think to myself, my gosh, these people put all this money into this place. It's got this beautiful ambiance. The design is terrific. It's kind of unique. Will it really exist in 6 months?
Right.
You know, so worried about it as an economist, because I'm worried about the owner, what's going to happen, and all the people working there.
Right.
Personally, would I go and spend another $100 there versus somewhere $50? You know, when you're selling a sandwich for $20, it should be pretty special sandwich in Providence. And it's hard to make a very special sandwich for $20, you know?
Right. It's such a balancing act. Garrett has a philosophy that you should always start your prices low in the beginning. For the first 6 months, your prices should be very reasonable. You know, and I've learned so much from him about, you know, providing abundance and providing value for guests is the number one way to get repeat customers. You mentioned, you know, tourist business versus regulars. And of course, you know, we're located in the shadow of Fenway Park. We, you know, our bread and butter is Red Sox customers, pregame, postgame, but, you know, we care about those customers. We want to make sure that they have a great experience, but we want them to come back, because the guests that you make money off of, and that you, you know, certainly it's about more than money, but, you know, we're talking kind of in the through an economic lens. You know, the most profitable guests for you will be the guests that will come back, that will tell their friends, that, you know, will bring in friends, that will come in not just on a Saturday night when everybody else in the world wants to come in, but they'll come in on a Monday night. They'll come in January. They'll come in a rainstorm. Those are the guests that you want to reward and that you want to see coming back. There will always be tourists. And that's the unfortunate thing about bad restaurants, is that there will typically be tourists that will support them. You know, and you, there's typically a little bit of, there's some leveling and kind of some natural survival of the fittest that happens through consumer choice and preference. You know, you'll know if a restaurant is not charging reasonable prices or providing good food or good service. But for us, you know, identifying when something is going wrong in a meal gives us the opportunity to change it. So it, for me, what I tell the staff is it's completely unacceptable for you to go to a restaurant twice and have two bad experiences and for us to not know about it. At, you know, at the end of your first experience, we have the opportunity in the middle, in the end, you know, throughout the entire experience to change that for you. And certainly there are things that we can't control in the middle of the shift. You know, if it, like you said, if the chef is crazy, if the food is bad, you know, but there are things that we can do. There are always solutions to issues in every situation. And sometimes that's giving someone a gift card to come back. I would rather spend $50, $100 to have that person come back 10 more times. That, you know, that's worth it to me.
I wonder whether it be doing this rather unusual thing of sitting down, giving somebody, you know, the option, let's say free dessert, if you can give me a really frank assessment of a really frank, honest, you got to tell me exactly what you're thinking about what, you know, your experience here.
Right.
How was it, you know, what was wrong with the food? Don't tell me what was right. Tell me what was wrong. And that might be a way of right off the bat, getting a lot of good feedback. Anyway, just
think many restaurants that. will do a friends and family service before opening. So, you know, you've been training your staff for a couple of weeks, for a month, and you need to test the waters.
Right.
So you invite in your friends and family, you invite in people who work in the restaurant industry who won't judge you. Certainly they're getting a free meal, but you know, they'll give you honest feedback, but they won't say, you know, that was terrible, I'm never coming back, because they know that this is, they're part of the training exercise. So you invite people in, they get a free meal. Sometimes they get what you are dictating that they'll get so that you can make sure the kitchen gets reps on every single dish. But you know, more often than not, they're presented with a limited menu and they can order from that. So that's a really good way to get honest feedback. But then to your point, it's just about being hypervigilant as to what the guest sentiment is. It's reading reviews. It's talking with the staff. They're hearing from guests all the time about the, you know, how is this dish doing? How is this dish doing? It's looking at a product mix and seeing which dishes are selling and which dishes aren't.
How much of the plate is still half filled?
Exactly.
When it comes back into the kitchen.
Which dishes get comped or refired more than others? You know, for example, when we first opened, we still have a beautiful half chicken dish on the menu. We were cooking it. There's a machine that we have that we were cooking it in advance, and then we were able to hold it at a certain temperature. So, it's beautiful heritage chicken, free range, with beautiful musculature, and we're cooking in advance. So it's really juicy and tender. But time and time again, we receive feedback that guest perception was that it was undercooked because it's such quality meat. The color of the muscle is a little bit darker than a lot of guests expect. So they cut into it and it's really juicy and they see that darker color and they say it's undercooked. So you have to reconcile your vision of the dish with what the guest perception is. And at the end of the day, the expression is the customer is always right in taste. You know, it's important to include that the customer is always right in taste because the customer is not always right, but to their taste, they are always correct.
If they were blindfolded, they would love it. If they were not, they would.
Right. You know.
So so you changed.
You better believe we changed that chicken dish and we haven't had any issues since then. So, you know, it's about compromise. You may have a vision for something. You may want it to be plated a certain way, but you see the line cooks are not able to execute that every single time. And restaurants are as much about consistency as they are about creativity. You're nowhere if you can write a beautiful menu that's creative and, you know, and seasonal that can't be executed. I need the dish to look exactly the same way every single time. I want Larry's table to be getting the exact same beet salad as the six top in the corner, as the as the new mom and dad sitting at the high top table at the bar, as the VIP sitting at the bar seat. So you need to make sure that the dish comes out exactly the same way every time. And some of that is making sure that you're ordering consistent product from your vendors, working with your vendors to make sure that they're sending you good, consistent product, but it's also about training.
Let's talk about retirement for a minute. It's something Americans think about regularly. Ask yourself, how financially secure do you really feel? Do you have enough money to retire? How much is really enough? And if you don't have enough money, how can you possibly find that extra money before you do retire? These are all tough questions. My retirement software, Maxify Planner, is the powerful online planning tool that takes the guesswork out of retirement. It weighs your assets against your fixed expenses to calculate how much you can safely spend every year for the rest of your life based on when you decide to retire. And it shows you safe ways to find more money. Maxify makes a complicated problem like retirement planning simple. It's accurate, easy to use, and produces what you really seek, peace of mind. So make the smart choice and visit Maxify.com today. Don't miss this opportunity. That's Maxify with an I, M-A-X-I-F-I, Maxify.com. Now let's get back to the podcast. So let me ask you just maybe a final question or two here. Maybe you have some final thoughts to add. But, you know, I've noticed that the American cuisine seems to be changing in certain ways. Obviously, we have maybe fewer hot dogs and hamburgers in some degree with vegan. You know, where people are concerned about their weight and healthy food and organic food. But they're also, one of my kind of observations is that things have become, just no matter where you go, saltier. Is that something that's something that the industry kind of recognizes, that this is actually people's preferences for salt has increased? It might be that as I'm aging, I'm becoming more salt sensitive, and it might be me as opposed to the broader world of cooking. But I was just wondering what you thought of that.
Salt is maligned sometimes, I think. You know, salt is an ingredient that's so important in every dish because it amplifies flavors and it makes the dish sing. Sometimes when you taste a dish and you say something's missing and I don't know what it is, it's oftentimes salt. But it's so important. If we learned anything from Samin Nosrat, it's that you have to build salt in stages. You can't just dump a bunch of salt on once the steak is cooked. You know, it's about building salt into the dish and building seasoning into the dish over time. You know, when you're building the pan sauce, when you're, you know, when you're basting the steak, for example, all of these are different times for you to add salt and therefore flavor when you're salting the steak in advance before you cook it. So sometimes when you taste a lot of salt up front, it's because the restaurant has taken some shortcuts and they're trying to fix a dish at the very ends just with a smattering of salt. But, you know, I do think that restaurants typically salt more than consumers do when they're cooking at home. You know, and I think some of that is because consumers undersalt when they're at home. You know, so I think there's some alignment that needs to happen that takes me back to the customer's always right in taste. You know, if we think something is perfectly salted and it makes the acid sing and the dish really just pops, but consistently guests are telling us that it's too salty, then it's too salty. That's the reality. You know, it doesn't matter what we think about the dish. It matters what the perception is, because at the end of the day, your goal is to bring guests in and to make money and to make people happy. And if you can't take feedback like that and adjust what you're doing, and whether that's, you know, adjusting the amount that you're salting or adjusting the dish entirely so that there's some kind of compromise where you feel good about the products you're putting out, but guests also perceive it to be more well-rounded than you know, you have to figure something out.
And then, okay, so moving away from the kind of micro making of a dish, but to the macro composition of the menu of food, do you see major trends going forward, or have you seen, if you go back to menus from the 1950s versus today, it's kind of a little bit of pretty much day and night, no?
I think so. You know, I think some of that is driven by how guests want to eat. As you mentioned, you know, there are health concerns that there weren't back then. But a lot of it is also due to cost and having a balanced menu. And, you know, we can't have an entirely meat focused or a seafood focused menu the way that we were able to have because of supply chain and because of, you know, certainly because of sustainability concerns. It's not sustainable to have a menu.
Roster, yeah.
Exactly. You know, and there are vendors that you can work with that can provide you with more sustainable options, but we're seeing a move away from those kind of typical luxury proteins towards things that are more sustainable, that are often more value driven, and, you know, more.
Yeah, answering a question and slightly off this topic. I mean, people are trying to sustain their own lives partly in eating, right? And they have self-control problems. They're well documented in economics. And the dessert, of course, is part of that. You know, if I wonder, I've always wondered whether it would be better, you know, when I go to a restaurant and they bring me a big dish and I end up overeating, I kind of think to myself, well, what if they had given me the option of just before they served it to me, taking half of it home? Just give me half of the food on the plate and giving me the rest to take home. Would I have taken that before I started eating it and now my glands take over and now I can't stop like taking that last, you know, or what if I could have half of the dessert and take the other half home? Just wondering if that's something you guys have ever thought about. Doing crazy things, off the wall things might be a way of, hey, this place is great, so economical, the prices are good to begin with, but you also, you don't have to, you know, kind of let yourself overeat. They help you not overeat.
Right. It's a really interesting concept. You know, my fear is that even if guests are opting for that option, there's still the perception when the dish is dropped of value. And in the restaurant's case, it's always better for me to put something in front of you that feels abundant, that you're presented with all of the bucatini with clams at once so that you see, look at how abundant this dish is. You know, there's something subconscious that happens when you see that, where you're justifying, oh, it was $29, but look at all of this value that I'm getting, you know? And so for you to see all of that at once together and then eat half of it and take it home, there, it feels more satisfying to you as a customer than having the option in advance. I assume, you know, it would be really interesting to conduct a case study, but I think if you ask guests afterwards, which option made you feel more, you know, more perceived value, I think they would say being presented with the visual of the big plate, eating their fill, and then taking some home.
It's also the issue of, you know, if you're around a table with friends and you right. order, I'd like to just have half of the food and the rest box, then the other people feel bad. They might have wanted to eat the whole thing.
Right.
They feel bad, like they're, you know, gluttons. And then the whole socialization here, the group think here is kind of interesting.
Right.
You know, I guess there's been studies, you probably are aware more of these than I am, that if one person orders dessert, others will. If the first person probably is asked about dessert, doesn't order it. And then, you know, the other on that, restaurants give people the option of looking at dessert menus. Maybe they should just be saying, do you want to order your dessert in advance? Because it takes time to, I've heard that too. Takes time.
Right.
To
it takes
prepare.
45 minutes to make your souffle, you know, and sometimes getting, it's something that restaurants will do at lunch where they'll print dessert options on the menu so that, you know, when you start thinking about it as part of your meal, you see it on there, then you'll sort of budget within yourself, whether that's budget financially, budget calorie wise, you know, budget stomach space wise.
Maybe here's a dessert that you can all, here's a dessert for the table.
Right.
You want that. That might be actually a way of getting everybody on board. This is like a group thing. I don't want to deprive somebody else of dessert.
Right.
And this whole psychology here, how to interact on at this level, is it seems to me to be quite interesting.
It is. You know, well, and we haven't yeah. even talked about takeout. You know, the other one of the big issues is that restaurant food doesn't travel super well. You know, certain things like Chipotle are engineered to travel well and to provide you with a near exact experience when you get it home 25 minutes versus when you're eating in the restaurant. But at a restaurant like Eastern Standard, you know, if you box up half of your food and you take it home, it's never going to be as delicious as it was when it was just made and put in front of you.
That's so, reheated and it's, yep.
Exactly. Right. You know, so then you have that's the last memory that the guest is left with of your restaurant. You say, I went to Eastern Standard and, you know, I don't remember much about the experience, but the last thing that I remember was eating that steak frites at home and it was okay. It wasn't amazing. I'm probably not going to go back. So I would rather leave people with the memory of the entire experience. And certainly, you know, if they opt to take something home, but it's one of the reasons why takeout and delivery is, you know, there are myriad reasons, and certainly so many financial reasons why it's a challenging business for restaurants. But for many restaurants, it was the life raft during COVID. And we've seen so many restaurants pivot to include delivery as part of their business model. You know, there are pros and cons to it. The delivery services totally gouge you. They take 22% of your gross revenue off the top. That's before you think about things like rent and labor and cost of goods. But in exchange, you're not paying front of house staff to be serving tables, you know, and washing dishes and things like that. So there's, you know, there are trade-offs. Then you have packaging costs. But, you know, then you don't have to pay a host to show guests to the table. So there are, you know, there are pros and cons. Sure. But it's really, for me, I feel like it boils down to the quality of the food and the quality of the experience, you know, and we've made our business in providing guests with a place where they feel seen, where they feel heard, where we're responsive to feedback, both good and bad. And I can't give that to guests when they're getting mac and cheese delivered, you know? Yeah.
Got it. So Sophie, this has been a really fascinating discussion. Sophie Cranin's fascinating discussion of the economics of restaurants. And you're not just a linguist. And what else did you study in college?
Public health.
Public health, health economy, health expert, I'm sure. An HR expert, a restaurateur, manager of restaurants, a marketer, software executive, in effect. You have your own software company, or at least you did. You're multi-talented. It just shows you that one person can do lots of things, that we're not stuck in a rut, and we have lots of talents unless we try them or somebody recognizes them or forces us to try something. It's like trying a dish that you've never eaten. You might decide you love it, and or you might be really good at it, good at eating this thing. So you're an inspiration. I will be into the restaurant to see you soon. And it was great to have you on. Best to Garrett.
Thank you. We'll see you soon.